in the forests, in fishing, in all sorts of natural resource industries. And we see folks losing their jobs when action against to prevent climate change isn't done in a way that preserves jobs well. So labor needs to be part of this conversation to make sure that we're standing up for the people who did the least to cause this problem, working people, and making sure that our solutions are protecting our jobs and making for a more sustainable, both environmentally and economically, economy for all of us. We have to be part of the solution.
And how is the Oregon AFL-CIO getting involved?
We've had conversations quite a bit for the last couple of years, and they're actually, you know, heating up with our partners in the environmental movement in Portland around how we can work together for solutions in Oregon. We try to support each other's work. We've been supporting, you know, various policies to help combat climate change in Oregon. And nationally, the labor movement's doing the same thing. So we've got to keep those conversations up, and we've got to be taking action.
Anything else you want to say to our listeners, particularly union members?
You know, I know there's a lot of people who are out here today. I want to thank everybody for being involved, and I would just encourage everybody in the labor movement to talk to their friends who, you know, are active in environmental causes and find those places of common ground where we can find good solutions together.
Thank you, Ilana Gwinney, Oregon AFL-CIO. I'm here talking with Rob Noss, who's a representative of in the Oregon State House and currently a representative with the Oregon Nurses Association.
Yes, sir.
And a former organizer with Service Employees Union. Rob, why are you here today?
Because climate change is going to affect working people. It's going to affect all people. And if we don't find a way to mitigate it in a meaningful way, working people are going to see a lot of problems in their lives and for their families.
What do you hope to accomplish in the state legislature or in your position as a state representative with regard to climate change?
Well, I hope we can put some strategies in place that reduce the amount of carbon and fossil fuels that we're burning in the state and do it in a way that doesn't harm working people, you know, and disadvantage them economically. I think that's going to be a very tough thing to figure out, but that's what I think we're charged with doing.
Do you have a particular message for union members or people who are involved with the working class movement?
Just that we have to team up with people that are in the environmental movement and other social justice movements to try to figure this out if we're going to have, you know, a reduction in carbon and fossil fuels that's done in a way that doesn't hurt, you know, working class and middle class people. I don't think there's any easy answers, but we've got to figure out something.
Great. Thanks, Rob Noss. Next up, Tom Chamberlain, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, speaking from the platform.
And there are those who want to force workers to choose between good jobs and the environment. And there are those who only support environmental change on the cheap, on the back of workers. Those are false observations and false choices. The fact is, there is global warming. It's accelerating every day, and it's impacting men, women, and children, and future generations. Whether it's an oil spill in the Gulf that threatens entire ecosystems and the jobs that are dependent upon it, or a hurricane or a tornado that destroys a home that was built upon a lifetime of sweat and toil that may never be replaced. For too many of our elected leaders that deny that there's a problem, or at best talk about good job creation and saving our planet, then turn right around and support trade agreements with little or no worker or environmental protections. But we are blessed in Oregon. We are blessed in Oregon to have leaders like our governor and U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley who are advocates for the working people and a good environment. Far too many view workers and the environment as factors in an equation for increased profits. Such a practice abuses our planet and our people. Today, we gather. And I hope you all understand when we gather like this, we create power. And to change things, my sisters and brothers, you have to create power because people don't do things just because they like you. They do things because they fear you. When 300,000 gather in New York, when 5,000 gather in Portland, We send a message around the world that we are not satisfied. We are not satisfied with a planet that's on the verge of destruction or an economy that exploits workers. When we join together, we will change the world and create an economy that works for all our people. Thank you.
Tom Chamberlain, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO.
That was tonight's Labor Radio Show. For co-host Jamie Partridge, myself, John Walsh, and thanks to Mike on the soundboard. We thank you for listening. Hope you tune in next week. Going to be a one-hour special on elections. Thanks for listening. Good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Two years ago, Portland lost a musical and cultural icon with the passing of Ghanaian master drummer, bandleader, and teacher Obo Adi. His contribution to the raising of local knowledge and appreciation of African music in general, and Ghanaian music in particular, and his tireless work with local youth cannot be overstated. As part of our fall membership drive, KABU is proud to present a celebration and retrospective of Obo's work on Thursday, October 2nd, from 1 until 4 p.m. Musical offerings, remembrances, and interviews will be part of this important figure's legacy. Join Andy Hosh and DJ Charlie and others at 1 p.m. on Thursday, October 2nd. The preceding hour, from noon until 1 p.m., will be filled with Ghanaian music as part of DJ Charlie's regular World Beat Connection time slot. See you then.
September 23rd is National Voter Registration Day. KABU is a co-sponsor of the Bus Project's partnership with the national effort to register voters before Election Day this November. Starting in 2012, National Voter Registration Day is designed to create an annual moment when the entire nation focuses on registering Americans to exercise their right to vote. On September 23rd, the Bus Project will have their signature bus parked in Pioneer Square and host a day filled with guest speakers, games, and prizes. More information, including how to volunteer with the Bus Project, may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand column of our homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM here in the Portland, Oregon area. I'm your host, Peter Pincel, and we're here tonight with Maureen Frary, the programs manager for the Washington County Jail over in Washington County. Maureen, could you please introduce yourself for the audience?
Yeah, I'm Maureen Frary. I've been managing programs in the jail for about 18 years now. I was hired when the new jail was being built in Washington County. It was a new style of facility, unlike the old cell block style. This was where they called direct supervision, and so they decided they needed programming in this building and hired me to sort of make it all up and make it happen, and I'm still there.
All right. Could you paint a picture for the audience? What does the direct supervision jail look like compared to the cell block?
Well, the old, they call linear style jail was one where the deputies would wander around. Like once in a while, it'd be a catwalk, and the inmates would basically be in control inside of it, but you'd check once in a while to make sure nobody was dead or something. In the new style, the deputy's actually sitting in the housing unit with the inmates, and so that's why I call it direct supervision, because they're there directly interacting with them 24 hours a day. so it really cuts down on assaults and problems, vandalism. The deputy's in control, not the inmates in that style facility.
So the deputy's sitting amongst the prisoners. That actually sounds more dangerous.
It's not. They manage. The deputies do an amazing job. I mean, they're very well trained and they know how to manage folks. But also, it's just the idea is that there's checks and controls. As long as you're behaving yourself, you get to be in direct. You get to be out. You get to be doing things like coming to programs. If you start to be a behavior problem, then the level of restriction goes up, and people know that. And so most people want to have more freedom, even if it isn't a jail.
So I think pop culture would have us believe that jails are dank places with no light and dirty and things along those lines. But that doesn't sound like this is what Washington County Jail is like at all.
No.
How does it compare to a typical jail?
Well, I think corrections in general is coming along. I mean, it's gotten a lot more professional over the years and using research and training and all its standards and certifications and credentialing that didn't happen in the past. I mean, the idea of, you know, some dungeon-y style jail is sort of, they still exist, but they're becoming a thing of the past. Washington County is like there aren't, you know, you don't hear the big clangs. The doors are shut pneumatically, so they close relatively softly. A lot of the housing units have wooden doors because, again, the inmates are expected to behave, and most of them are in their own cells, so there's a lot of accountability about behaving. And you're rewarded for good behavior and that you get to do more stuff. And you're, you know, given sanctions for not doing the right thing, including less, you have less things to do. So it's light, it's bright, it's clean. They do a really good job of making sure it stays that way because that reduces stress. Controlling volume and sound, managing inmates so that they know what to do, what to expect, really manages stress and as well as just the physical plant.
So has this model been successful so far?
Yeah, definitely. I think research has shown that the old cell block style, linear style facility has a lot more assaults, a lot more problems with inmates controlling each other and doing things they shouldn't, and really not responding well to being in. The stress level is way up. The assaults go way down, and it's the overall feel of the place is much more managed. And the stress level goes down. And when your stress level's down, you're much more able to try to do things like take advantage of programming. You can think. You can sleep.
So you say you're with the programs department. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it was decided in Washington County, even 18 years ago, that having some sort of programming to help inmates do better, both inside the facility and to lower their likelihood to come back, was important. And there was a lot of evidence and research at that time that you can do things to really impact the likelihood that someone's going to come back to jail or prison. So the decision was made that they wanted to have programs to do that in this jail. One thing, it really helps keep inmates busy in this style facility. And the other was that they recognized that the reality was you can do things. And if inmates are going to be inside a jail, you can just let them sit there and become bigger victims, or you can do something to help them do better when they get out. And the choice was made to do that. So the programs were developed with all that research in mind to try to do the right thing, you know, to use evidence-based practices to try to help inmates do better when they get out and when they're there too.
Introduce to us what sorts of programs are available to these inmates.
Well, we do all kinds of things in there, but one of the main things in order to impact what people are doing behavior, which is an important goal when they get out, is to sort of look at the connection between what you believe and then the actions you take is the behavior, and then what the consequences are, and that if that's really getting someone where they want to be. And what we do, a lot of we call our programs Think Again, something called Options, which is, again, thinking about stuff, is to try to get inmates to connect the dots between what they believe, entrenched beliefs that are then contributing to what they do, and not getting them where they want to be, which is not in jail. They called it cognitive restructuring. That's one term for it. Other people have called it other things. There's cognitive skill building, cognitive this, cognitive that. But mostly it's that your brain has a lot to do with what you do. And you can control what you believe as much as you control your behavior. And you kind of have to control what you believe if you want to control your behavior. We have three counselors. So again, we recognize that you got to impact beliefs and thinking for especially this a more entrenched group, because we're really focused on people that are a little higher risk to reoffend, because that's where you get the biggest bang for your buck. But we also realize there's skill deficits that people have. So we have on-site GED testing, instruction to prep people for GED. We have English as a second language classes, parenting classes, computer classes, employment classes. And we're trying to not just, you want to provide people with inside the jail with an opportunity to build on skills and also tweak those attitudes so that they don't see themselves as big victims anymore, that they don't see themselves as lacking responsibility or thinking it's okay to victimize, that they get a clue about that maybe that's what they believe, and that if they really want to get what they want, they need to work on that. But then you also, that's really important, and that's at the basis of a lot of it, but you also want to help them build on skills that they need to be able to go out and get a job or find housing or get into treatment or other things that we want to access for them and help them within the community when they get out. I mean, we're really big on, you know, having the walls be sort of permeable. Instead of the fortress on the hill, we want it to be something where the community is coming in, getting to know folks, working with them, and then so that they have this feeling of a warm reception when they get out. And that's true of the employment person that's from Southeast Works. Works inside the jail, but he also follows the inmates out and works with them in the community to try to help them be gainfully employed on the outside. We have some folks from Mercy Corps that come in to guest speak that are a part of the transition program in Multnomah County, the center there. We have people from community colleges that come in from time to time, apprenticeships that come in. And we have we have someone from LifeWorks who does a gambling group on the inside. So there's lots of different ways that we're trying to reach in from the community so that when people get out, they're much more likely to move forward and continue to participate. Because you're right, jails are different than prisons. They're both a processing plant, because jails do all the booking and hold pre-sentenced people, as well as hold sentenced people that are there for a period of time. And so the average length of stay is probably, it varies, but maybe 45 days, because some people are only there 2 days, and some people are there for a year. And we have a tendency to work with the people that are there a little longer by jail standards, but compared to prisons, it's a drop in the bucket. So you got to do things quickly and connect them with community resources. And there's a more intense level of programming that we do for people that we assess, and if they're, you know, shown to be higher risk, there's a cluster of things that come together to make them more high risk to reoffend. We'll target them. And there's probably about 90 of those at any given point in time with counselors. But then there's a whole other group that we make programming available to, where we're not necessarily assessing them in that way, but we're just offering programs. They can go to school. They can get employment classes. They can get parenting classes. And they could maybe only there in like a few weeks. But we want to make sure that we can offer things to a bigger portion of the jail population. And how many that is at any given point in time, it just depends on who signs up. How many are in segregation that can't come, and other things. You know.
So all these programs are voluntary?
No, they're not. We call them recommended programs, the more intense program where there's a counselor assigned, because, you know, a person could say, I don't want to come, I refuse. But there's a consequence to that. If they're sentenced and we expect them to try to do something to get better before they get out, we're going to give them a little bit of a hammer if they don't cooperate. So the incentive is some of these people get work credit. They can get time off their sentence for doing it if their sentence allows. But there's also a consequence if they refuse. A lot of these folks that are higher risk to reoffend sometimes aren't going to run down and jump up and down and say, yes, please help me with my thinking. That's not been what they do. So we want to sort of get into the water and help them see that it's really not that bad. And most of them, after they get there, they're, oh, okay, all right, you know, I see, it's not as bad as I thought. But we have to have a little bit of that consequence in there to get them motivated to come. The stuff for people who aren't assigned a counselor and assessed, that's totally voluntary. They sign up if they want to or don't.
You mentioned that you want to provide these programs to the individuals who have the highest risk of, and recidivism is the term that is often used for individuals who commit a new crime and go back to incarceration. That seems kind of counterintuitive. Wouldn't you kind of want to get the low-hanging fruit, make sure those ones who are almost there are there?
Well, that would be easy. that would make the statistics look good, but they don't really need it that much. They're not likely to reoffend anyway. So what you want to do is go after the folks who need it the most. And those folks are really responsible for, they get rearrested, and they're responsible for so much more crime than the people who aren't likely to do it again. So you really want to go after those. If you're going to make an impact in community safety and on really, you know, targeting folks who are doing the majority of the crime, you really need to go after those high-risk folks. And I don't mean high-risk in the terms of the type of offense. It's not that we're saying high-risk because they did something really heinous. It's high risk in terms that they're going to stay in the system. They may be low-level property crimes, you know, theft, stealing things from stores or something, which the stores don't like. But, I mean, it's not like they're public enemy number one. But they cost a lot in terms of, you know, what they're doing in the community.
Let's take a short break. We'll be back in a moment.
Understand me now. Sometimes I feel a little mad. Don't you know that knowing a life can always be an angel? Things go wrong, you're bound to see it bad. But I'm just this old whose intentions are good. Come along, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Maureen Frary, Program Manager of the Washington County Jail. Do you have a story of someone that you've worked with, someone who's been successful?
Yes. There was actually, he was a little high profile because there was a German, I won't mention his name, but there was a German documentary about this individual because he was homeless and he had, I believe it was 8 kids. And he and his wife were estranged and he had some issues with substances. And there was a particular judge who thought that it would be good if he was very into meaningful sentencing, meaning that it's not just punishment. I mean, there's in our society, there's a punishment factor. Obviously, people want to see people who do bad things and get a major time out. It's just the way it is. But he wanted it also to have that time mean something. So he tasked us with assessing this person and see if we can come up with something that would help him. And right now, he's got a job. He's been doing great. He and his family were reunited. It's been a few years since this happened, and it's a great story. It's a really big success story, and it feels really good. There was another individual who had tried to commit suicide several times. He and his wife had tried to commit a joint suicide after their son died, had committed suicide. She did. He didn't. He got convicted of manslaughter, came into the jail just totally depressed, had done some prison time, ready to, you know, off himself. And basically, we were tasked with trying to help him, but he was afraid that we were going to make him re-traumatize himself with all the painful past. And we said, we don't have to do that. We can start from now and just help you, you know, learn how to react better. We don't have to go through all that. And that was, he was so relieved about that. He just started participating 100%, and he's been doing great. He's out there. He had a girlfriend and bought a truck and doing great. So it does, I mean, these are anecdotal stories, but you'd see it work for people. You just have to be sensitive to what approach to take. One size does not fit all, even if it is a jail.
So thank you for sharing those. Now, how about some difficulties? What difficulties have you faced in this work?
Well, I mean, I think there's shows like this where you're giving me an opportunity to talk about it. But, you know, education is big. And like you say, people have misconceptions about what jails are like, what people in jails are like. And that, you know, all people that go to jail are bad and awful, and that why should you bother to do anything for these folks since they do awful things to society? They should just be punished. Just lock them away. Don't do anything for them. If I can't get it, why should they? And those kind of attitudes, I think, can make it hard for us to do our job because, you know, there's a resource. And if you get political figures who want to capitalize on those attitudes and get hard on crime, and they can, you know, want to snatch your resources away. So that's a big mistake. I mean, there's this whole push towards reinvestment that has been going on, not only in the state, but others, where it's obvious you can't build yourself out of this problem. You have to do something to try to work with people so that they can be better in society. You're not building more and more prisons is not the answer. And I think people are really understanding that, but there's still a, I think people have a lot of misconceptions and some beliefs that perhaps if we worked on those beliefs with them, they'd see the value in this, because these folks are going to get out. Even the people in prison eventually get out. Most of them are not life sentences. You know, most of them get out and they're going to be living next to you. Do you want them to get out better or bigger victims? I guess that's the question.
So when you, I've heard you use that term a couple times, referring to the individual in the justice system as a victim. Tell us more about that.
Well, there's things that are antisocial attitudes that are, you know, when we're talking about working on attitudes and beliefs, so these are some of the ones that, you know, are very predictive of reoffending. Because if you believe that you're a victim, that society owes you because something bad happened to you as a kid, or you're entitled to steal because that's just what society owes you, or you feel like it's everybody else's fault, it's the judge's fault, it's your parents' fault, it's your PO's fault, and of course, you're much more likely to continue doing it because you have no accountability for it. And if you just help someone get more entrenched in those beliefs, you're going to help them continue to be a criminal. And just punishment does not help people not feel like a victim.
So I read on the website a little bit about caring for children of incarcerated parents. Tell us more about that.
Well, unfortunately, that's dwindled a bit. But we had a period where there was an organization that came through, a national organization that came through Washington County, probably 7-8 years ago now, and wanted us to try to help put a spotlight on this group of kids who are, you know, kind of overlooked a lot. A lot of people don't even know in the school system or their friends that these people, maybe their parent all of a sudden went into custody. They were there one day and the next day they're not there. And so we were asked if we could come up with a way in the county to try to help maybe do something for these kids. And the sheriff then at that time was Rob Gordon. And he asked me to sort of be a part of that. And so there was a big group of people. There was a woman named Mary Nunnenkamp that was there at that time in the sheriff's office, and put together a big event with all these stakeholders in Washington County that got together and came up with some great things to do to help. And out of that came a subcommittee from people from the school district, homeless liaisons from the school districts in around Washington County. And also people from the DA's office and defense and a public defender's office, juvenile, Boys and Girls Club, a whole bunch of people were part of this. And out of that, we came up with a way that we could help identify people in jail, and then I could let the homeless liaisons from the school districts know so that the schools would have a sense that's what these kids might be going through and reach out and support them. Because there's some behavioral things that can happen in schools when kids have just had a parent go into custody, and you think they're just acting out, but it's because of that, and you really respond to them differently if you know. And also don't do dumb stuff like call them out and other things that you shouldn't be doing. And so it was both an educational thing for the schools, who I think really, you know, like Beaverton School District and Forest Grove School District and the Tigard School District were really great in being there to try to be a part of this project. And there were a number of times when we really identified somebody. There were a couple of twins that were living with a grandparent on the beach, and the homeless liaison from Beaverton actually reached out to that liaison in the coastal community because they had no idea. People in the school didn't know, these grandparents didn't have enough money, what these kids were going through. And the counselor, you know, started working with them. It made a huge difference that we could figure that out. We had a person coming in, a family mentor for a while as a part of a grant program in Washington County that was working with people in our parenting classes, and it really helped these people feel motivated to reach out and identify their kids. But that grant went away, the mentor went away, and so we're not seeing nearly as many reach out to us, but it's a really good thing.
So just a moment ago, you mentioned Sheriff Rob Gordon with a wry smile. Why?
Well, Rob, you know, when I started, Rob Gordon was the commander of the jail, and he was just awesome. he was very open-minded about learning about all these things and was very supportive. And he was the commander and also then was sort of the lead as on the transition team when the new jail was being built. And he was always really ready to listen, you know, and think about what I was talking about. And if I could back up what I was saying with some credible research, he was willing to listen. And so he's been supportive in making this all happen. And the sheriff that replaced him, Pat Garrett, is also very supportive. Smart man, and really wants to do the right thing. And so I feel blessed that I came to a county where you could do this kind of stuff, because not all of them are like that.
So, Maureen Frary, program manager of the Washington County Jail, what else do you want us to know?
I think just that. Some people can have this idea that both that jails should be just punishment and you lock them away, and some people have a fear that people are going to a jail and they get nothing. It's just a warehouse. So there's these extreme ideas, well, don't put them in there because they're not going to get anything, or stick them in there and they shouldn't get anything. But it's really not, and Washington County Jail isn't true in either way. If ideally inmates would be connected to the community, and if that's what's going to work best for them, that's where they are. So you don't put people in jail who don't need to be. But on the other hand, if having a little more time to get yourself together without the stresses of the outside world is a good idea, then we have a lot of things going in there that we can offer. So I guess we're neither the black hole of Calcutta, you know, and we're not, you know, Hilton Hotel either. It's like most people, believe it or not, do not want to be in jail, even with GED programs and counselors.
So what's the most exciting part about this work?
Seeing people get it. It's incredibly exciting when the light goes off and you see people get it. I also have the opportunity right now, because we just switched to computerized GED testing, to be the proctor for GED testing. I decided to pick that up myself. So, and watching people's reaction when you tell them they passed, this is incredibly, it's gotten a lot harder, and it's just awesome. So that's great. And also, I think just, I'm really pleasantly surprised at how great so many people are that work in Washington County, both in the mental health part of the county, in, you know, the courts, the